the invitation to speak here. That's really very nice for me, a very nice opportunity. And what I wanted to talk about today is something that has been forming a red line in a lot of the research that I'm doing. And you can basically characterize this as the cosmic web. That is the structure of the universe, not on the largest global Hubble scales, but the structure on the universe on more local scales, scales of a couple of megaparsecs up till several hundreds of megaparsecs. And over the past decades, we have learned that the structure of the universe on those scales is characterized by a rather complex structure, a web-like structure, almost like a spider web. This is the result of a lot of observational analysis, observational campaigns, and that went along with a lot of computer simulations that have at least showed that this is to be expected as a remnant of evolution of structure from the early universe. It's only over the past few years, decade perhaps, in which we have started to really get more insight into some of the physical challenges that this structure gives us. And I hope that in the coming hour, I sort of can give you a sort of an overview of developments that have been going on based on what we have learned over the last decades in terms of the observational reality that we are talking about. So it's going to be a combination of some issues on a more mathematical plane concerning structural complexity, but on the other hand, very close towards the observational reality that we see around us. What you see here in the background is basically a reconstruction based on some techniques that we have developed over the years, based on computational geometry, and then also on Bayesian reconstructions of the dark matter distribution, and then further evolved towards today. And what you see over there is almost like an image of the supposed hypothetical structure of the universe in dark matter towards not, oh, let me see this, not real, completely theoretical picture, but a real observational reality. What you see over here is nothing else than a real observed structure. It's the Piscus-Perseus chain filament of galaxies. So we can even nowadays start to get an idea of what the structure is in the dark matter distribution. So I hope that I sort of can give you a little bit of an insight into what has been happening. Now, this work is certainly not my own work. Actually, most of the work is contributed by students and postdocs with whom I work together. And I certainly want to mention Bernard Jones, Miguel Aragon Calvo, Marius Cotin, and Jop, who's sitting here and who is the main reason that I'm visiting here over the coming week. Johan Hidding and Steven Reeder, I should certainly mention them. Now, first, what are we talking about? Yes?
That picture in the previous slide, what is the size of the galaxy?
I will explain later on what the context is to galaxies. It will come, it will become slightly more clear. Now, first of all, let me introduce you to the subject by just giving you an impression of what kind of structures we are talking about. And this is based on simply a simulation. This is a large simulation called the Cosmogrid simulation. It's a simulation of dark matter only, the distribution of dark matter on scales of around, it's basically a box of 30 megaparsecs. And what you see over here is already an impression of the kind of distribution that you have. The bluer it is, the more dense it is. And when it gets white, it's really very high density. Now, this is going to be a CT scan through the box, through the simulation box. And it gives you a sort of an impression of the three-dimensional structure. As we are going through the box, you will notice that filamentary structures come and go. You see large, emptier spaces like you have here, basically starting small, blowing up, and then going back again. And you have to imagine that actually this is a CT scan through the three-dimensional structure. So what you in fact see is voids opening up and closing down. When you see the filamentary structures running through several scans, it's clear that it's not just an elongated structure, but that it's a wall-like structure. What you sometimes see is that large filamentary elongations are hanging in between large compact nodes. And that sort of gives you a view of what kind of structure we are talking about. So here we start with the thing, and we start at the bottom of the box. And you see, for example, here a large void-like region starts. It's not empty. It contains a lot of tendril-like structures. And then it closes down again. Here you see high-density nodes, this node disappearing. And you see that they are basically bridged by huge filamentary patterns that can, we know now from the observational reality, bridge up to 100 megaparsecs easily. You see that the structure is also not characterized by one scale structure. You see very large structures running right through the box, and at the same time, on much smaller scale, much fainter structures and much smaller structures. Right? That already gives you an impression of what we're talking about. At the same time, you see patterns like these nodes at these filaments and these walls, but they're not scattered around randomly. They are connected in a particular fashion. The connectivity is rather complex, and it's clear that they are not independent of each other. They are woven into a tapestry, as one of the founding people of this field, Dick Bond, has sometimes called it. And to those aspects, I want to draw attention in the coming hour. Right. So let me first give a short inventory of some of the quantitative aspects of this cosmic web-like structure. When we look at this structure, you could say, well, you know, you look at the box and you basically map the density field, the matter density field, and you ask yourself, you know, what is the density distribution? But as you saw, the density distribution is also consisting of morphological or topological elements, and you may wonder, where is most of the mass in the universe actually residing? So here is an analysis by a technique that we have developed called multiscale morphology filter nexus. So what we basically did is take simulations, but also observations, galaxy surveys, and sort of start to quantify and classify the structures that we see. It's actually coming from medical research, because medical doctors in hospitals sometimes have to look through huge amounts of CT scans. And of course, after going through dozens of CT scans, your attention span goes down. And even when you see something suspicious, like lumps, you would like to pick them up automatically. Now, this same technique is what we apply, but then to the cosmic web. So we can actually get the veins or the arteries, which are the filaments, or the membranes, which are the walls, or the nodes, which are the clumps, which would, in medical situation, perhaps be a suspicious lump, right? These kind of things. So this is actually a nice cross-fertilization. We applied that, and what you then get is the following. When you look at the mass distribution in the universe, you see that in terms of mass, 50% of the matter in the universe is actually residing in filaments, elongated stretches. They actually are gonna be the transport channels in the universe. A lot of mass is also in the nodes, in these compact clumps that are connecting these filaments. Although when you look in volume fraction, you see that they occupy only 0.1% of the universe because they're very compact and they reach densities 1,000 times the average. At the same time, we see that in terms of volume, 77% is in areas that are very underdense, void-like regions that have a density of, characteristically, something like only 20% of the mass density, average mass density of the universe. Now, this is the dark matter distribution, but when you look at, for example, halos of galaxies or galaxies and apply this to simulations that look at this, you get almost the same numbers. So in terms of galaxies in the universe, approximately 50% is living in filaments. And in terms of trying to understand what galaxies are doing and where they are doing, you have to take into account that most of them are in these filaments. When you then say, well, you could do everything by not looking at this morphology or topology, but just look at the density. Well, look at this diagram. This diagram shows the distribution function as a function of density for example, here in blue, the filaments. Now look, this is a logarithmic diagram, and one is the average density of the universe. And you see that the filaments are actually spanning an enormous range of densities. You see that some of them are even underdense, though those tenuous tendrils that were living in the voids. At the same time, you have very heavy, compact filaments connecting up at these very high density nodes. And they reach densities in between 100 to 1,000 of the average of the universe. So clearly, density is not going to help you here in characterizing these filaments. You have to do something else. That's the reason we developed this technique. On the other hand, if you look like void regions, this is the voids, the dot dash, you see, well, yes, most of the void regions are indeed much less dense than the average of the universe. Most of them are around here in between a tenth and one equal to the density of the universe. Some of them are even recognized up till a density of 10. They are the lakes in the mountain landscape, right? Because the density field is basically consisting of mountain ranges. You could almost compare it to that. And of course, here and there, there are some lakes high up in the mountains that fill up as little voids, and they are those guys. Right? So you see that in that sense, it looks more like what you expect. These are the nodes. And you see some of the nodes are really quite tenuous, quite moderate, but some of them really dominant, around 1,000. And they are actually the clusters of galaxies that we see in the distribution of galaxies. So you see, it's a very rich palette of structures that correspond to different density levels. And you cannot just say that density is everything that you should consider. So in terms of characteristics, as I showed you in this CT scan and paying attention to this, the cosmic web, this web-like distribution of mass in the universe, has four major characteristics. One of them is very telling. The universe on those scales is characterized by distinct anisotropic patterns. It's not lumps. It's basically elongated filaments, flattened membranes, or something like that. That's clearly something that's going on. Number two, it's not one scale. You cannot say filaments are 100 megaparsecs. You see them on a whole range of scales. So it's clear multi-scale pattern. We get back to that at the end of the talk when we talk about how this multi-scale pattern is basically evolving. Another very characteristic element that you also saw in the CT scan is the asymmetry between the underdense regions and the overdense regions. Clearly, the underdense regions are occupying most of the volume, but representing the minor share of the mass. But as we know, the initial conditions in the universe were one of a mostly Gaussian random field with a strict symmetry between these, right? 50-50%. So clearly, the evolution that followed has been shifting this towards a much more asymmetric distribution with voids dominant in volume and mass dominated by filaments and nodes. And then the final characteristic is basically the complex spatial connectivity. It's clear that this is a geometric pattern, but with very clear connections, with nodes being the ends of the filaments, et cetera, et cetera. It's not a random distribution. It's a network. It it's a web, right? So
can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So I guess to define a density field, you have to coarse grain your simulation, but then your results you get would depend on the scale of coarse graining. And I guess that's what I'm trying to understand, is that to what extent is this resolution dependent?
Density is always resolution dependent. Yeah. So you're always constrained by the scales that you have available.
Separation of 50% filament, like
yeah.
20% node, et cetera. That, is that resolution
dependent? That's characteristic for the scales involved with this, with this pattern. Actually, what I mentioned, I'm not going into the specifics of this multi-scale morphology filter, but one of the characteristics is that it is multi-scale. So it basically looks over all the scales relevant and characterizes all the structures, the tenuous tendrils on their scale, the major filaments on their scale. So it looks at the characteristic scale of each pattern. Mm-hmm. And that, in the end, determines the inventory of the density.
But this is limited by the resolution.
Of course, you're always limited by the resolution.
So I guess what I'm trying to get to is, for example, in the so-called halo model of large scale structure, it assumes that all the mass lies in halos.
Yeah.
And of course, that's not the case in simulations, but one could argue that if you just resolve things better and better, then you get more and more mass in the halos. And so the question is that something that's could happen in your case as well? Or is there something that you're disagreeing with, that all the mass lies in halos?
If you go to the smaller scales, that will happen because everything breaks up. But we take into account basically the connectivity mm-hmm. that is given by what you have in your particle distribution. And then it doesn't happen. Then you always come up to this.
Okay, so you always come up to this?
Yeah. It's been quite these numbers have been quite consistently coming out of this, and also other studies that are based on other techniques characteristically seem to indicate this. Okay. So, the in terms of visual representation of these aspects, this is clearly anisotropy. This filament is the Piscus Perseus filament, and it's clearly an elongated structure that is very anisotropic. Somehow, gravity had been able, should have been able to form this. Multiscale, very clearly, this is an image from our multiscale morphology filter. It's basically a representation of a slice of the mass distribution, and in blue, you see everything that was characterized as filaments. Now, if you see this, you see that there is a major artery running through this simulation box. But it's not only the major artery, you also see that connected to this, branching out, are small tendrils, right? If you look in the low-density areas, like what you see over here, you see the smaller tendrils and no major arteries. When you show this basically to medical people, they think didn't get this from simulation of cosmological circumstances, but that this is either veins or arteries in the body. But it's, you know, that was just made as a lookalike. But it's clear that this is an interesting branching process that deserves some attention. In terms of voids, this is an interesting reproduction or reconstruction of the dark matter distribution in our own local universe, in an environment of around 100 megaparsecs. You see this cross is where we sit. This plane is edge-on from the local supercluster. It turns out that we ourselves are living in a kind of flattened structure called the supergalactic plane. That's this thing. The red dots are real galaxies observed by the TUMAS redshift survey. And on the basis of this distribution of redshift galaxies, using Bayesian reconstruction techniques for the initial density field and subsequent evolution by gravity, you get this structure of the structure in our local universe. And as you see the names, these things really have names. Even these gaps, these underdense regions, have names. They're real structures. As you see, we ourselves are living on the edge of a major void-like region called the local void or the Tully void, which is very empty. You could almost see like we're living on a, you know, sort of an edge of a cliff, looking down into a void. And clearly it shows that voids are a dominant feature of the local distribution of mass.
Sorry, what is the difference between the two?
They are two different planes, edge-on. So you should see this as a three-dimensional box with us at the center. So you look in this plane and you look at that plane, right? So this is both the local supercluster. I could also have shown the one like this, but in this way it looks, you know, like the local supercluster. It looks really. So it's nice to see that this is the real world, right? To some extent. And the complex connectivity, this is a sort of a three-dimensional image of also our local environment, but some dozen of megaparsecs further on the other side of a large void is another huge supercluster called the Piscis Perseus supercluster, with this characteristic filament that runs for almost 100 megaparsecs. And what you see is there is filaments running here too. This is walls, and you see the branching and the branches of the filaments and the way they are connecting up with each other and surrounding the empty voids, and this all in sort of representing the real world, right? Let me skip this one because we saw that already. Now, in terms of looking at this structure and seeing it's structurally interesting, you may wonder, why would you care? That's a question that's often asked, right? Well, one thing is you could say it's a beautiful structure, and in a sense, you could say it's the largest non-trivial structure that we see in the universe. Non-trivial meaning once you get to larger scales, you basically get only to see the still not fully evolved primordial distribution of the Gaussian initial conditions that we also recognize in the cosmic microwave background. This is the first kind of structures that are forming in the universe, and they look complex, intrinsically interesting. So, lar pular, you want to understand something that you see in the universe. A more physical argument would be, well, it is the first stage of structure evolution in the universe, and we better should understand what's going on there, taking into account that these structures we can see in real galaxy surveys, so perhaps we want to use those galaxy surveys to learn more about the universe, so we need to understand what we see. In fact, when we see this, we can hope that we can, on the basis of our dynamical understanding, take this and extrapolate it back to the initial conditions and see what would be the structure that you expect in different cosmologies. That brings me to the second point. You would need to want to know, well, we know that the cosmic microwave background gives us a lot of information about the overall cosmology, but given that this stuff is happening on large scales, has a direct link to the initial conditions, can we learn something about the universe on a more global scale? Does it have cosmological information? Would I expect, given initial conditions, different structures in different cosmologies? Or different structures, assuming not general relativity, but some modified form of gravity? Or different forms of dark energy? And actually, people are seriously looking into this. For example, we start to realize that voids are particularly nice regions to try to learn something more about dark energy or modified gravity, simply because they are underdense, and therefore their deviations from the more accepted forms of dark energy or gravity, there manifest themselves most prominently. The question whether, for example, filaments are telling us something about the overall cosmology, well, we know that in one case for sure. Because they are formed by gravitational fields, we actually can show that they would induce alignment. So for example, the angular momentum of galaxies. And you would expect them to see them aligned, at least when there are coherent gravitational forces over a large range. So potentially there are imprints there of the cosmology. For astronomers, extremely important is the third point. That is, we see that 50% of the galaxies are living in those filaments. Another 20-something percent is living in the clusters. What do these environments imply for the characteristics of these galaxies, right? Do we understand the environmental influences on the final form of galaxies? And only now people start to realize that indeed environmental influences may be extremely important to determine not only factors like the rotation, the angular momentum of galaxies, but also their star formation history, and therefore their final morphology, etc., etc. So also in that sense, the cosmic web may actually provide a lot of interesting information. So.
Sorry.
Yeah?
Can you give an effective theory for the dynamics of this evolution, in terms of the filaments?
I will do so later on. Okay? That's where. But I was first going to give sort of the rationale, and then show you something of reality, and then I go to the dynamics of these things. Okay? So, what do we know about the observational reality? How did we get the idea that the universe was organized in this way? Well, here is a beautiful image from the end of the 1970s. A million galaxies projected on the sky. They didn't yet have information on the depth of the galaxy. It's a map made by Jim Peebles based on the Shane-Virtanen counts. And now at hindsight, if you see this as the distribution of galaxies on the sky, is this not already suggesting that we see a filamentary pattern of a web-like pattern that we saw in these simulations? I would say, to some extent, now it's clear that this was already reflecting the underlying reality that we see over here. This is a result, one of the results of a very deep survey called VIPERS under the leadership of Luigi Guzzo, where they actually mapped the positions of galaxies out to a redshift of 0.5. And you sort of get a very nice impression of how sharp the different structures are in organized. And as you see over a huge range that the galaxies, here the blue dots, are indeed having this pattern of filaments and walls and voids and etc. out to pretty large depths into the universe. So this is really structures that we see in reality. Yeah?
So this web is the first structure after the non-trivial thing, but it doesn't seem to be different on closer scales, which are later in time.
Yes. So well, you have to remember that a redshift of 0.5 is still relatively close in terms of cosmic time. Cosmic time, the dynamical time scales on these scales, only start to kick in around after a redshift of 0.5 up to 1. Then you really see things substantially change. So the fact that you don't see any systematic changes on these scales is what you expect. Up to a redshift of 0.5, it's almost like you're looking at the time slice of the present.
So this web that we see are located in which ages of the universe?
Like this is, of billions? Let's say all of this is basically 13.8 billion years after the Big Bang. Okay? And so this is still all local stuff. Now, in terms of the distribution, the previous plot showed the neck or the VIPERS simulation, but in the meantime, machineries have been developed not only to look at the distribution of the galaxies, but also look at the distribution of the dark matter, which is gravitationally the dominant species of matter, And what you see here is a map that was obtained by Paco Quitaura on the basis of the two-mass redshift survey and a Bayesian inference machinery. He basically inferred the structure around us, here projected on the sky, with us at the center. So if we were able to see dark matter, we basically would see this spider web around us, and we would be caught in the middle of this spider web, right? So this is basically what the what the observations suggest. The dark matter distribution around us is going to be, or is, basically. But it's not only that. We can also look for remnants or for indications of this structure, not only in galaxies, not even in the dark matter, but also in the gas. Because most of the baryons of the universe are actually not in galaxies. Most of the baryons that we know of in the universe are still hidden and missing. Most indications are that they are actually hidden in the filaments and the sheets of the cosmic web, where they've been heated up in up to temperatures of around 100,000, and the dense area is 100 or a million degrees Kelvin. So we just can't see it. That's the warm and hot intergalactic medium. At high redshifts, you can most easily see it as Lyman alpha absorption of the neutral gas that is found in this cosmic web. And at the same time, in the highest density regions, you can actually recognize the filaments in between clusters by simply the scattering of cosmic microwave background photons due to the Soyaev-Soldovich effect. And all have been seen. For example, here is a beautiful map from the Planck satellite where Nabila Aghanim and several of her co-workers found, for example, the clear signature of the Soyaev-Soldovich effect, the inverse Compton scattering of cosmic microwave background photons by the hot intercluster medium in these clusters, but also the slightly less hot intergalactic gas in a bridge, a filamentary bridge, in between two of these clusters. This is a beautiful demonstration that these things are actually real, right? That they actually are full of gas and etc. In the meantime, not yet published, they found, they told me, around 80 filaments in between clusters in Soyaev-Soldovich effect in the Planck data. So you can really see them there. Coming back to the dark matter distribution, the earlier plot I showed you was the dark matter distribution inferred from the galaxy distribution. But you can also try to see it directly by looking at the imprint of the dark matter on the lensing, the gravitational lensing of the light path of the background galaxies as the light proceeds through the universe. That's basically gravitational lensing. And here is one of the maps recently published by the Dark Energy Survey, DES, where you basically see the projected mass distribution implied and inferred from the light bending, from the gravitational lensing. And you clearly see there some very prominent mass concentrations like these. These are clusters. But not only clusters, you clearly see that there's a lot of mass in between. And for example, here are indications of sort of flattened or elongated structures in the dark matter distribution. So here you already see imprints of this web-like structure, be it at a very low resolution here, because you cannot infer that from further. This is actually one that was specifically oriented by or taken by Dietrich et al., where they looked specifically at one of these guys and around a double cluster, A22 and Abel-223, the blue and the contours give you the dark matter projected mass distribution. You clearly see the clusters, but you also see a dark matter bridge in between them. So these bridges that I showed in the simulation, that was the dark matter, but then hypothetically in your model, are also there in reality, right?
The bright dots in the link, are they galaxies?
You mean here?
No, in the blue.
In the blue, yes, most of them are galaxies. And if you zoom in on this, you see the galaxy, I see the projection is a bit, everything is trapped. The point spread function of the beamer is not exactly useful for lensing, but you sort of get the effect that these are all galaxies, and they actually look at the mean elongation, deformation of the galaxy images. That is due to the lensing, and that can be inverted to yield the mass distribution. And that's basically what they do. Right?
And the dark matter doesn't clump into galaxies.
No, well, it is there, but they cannot get it from on these scales, because basically you need thousands of galaxies to find the mean deformation and et cetera. So lensing doesn't still have the resolution to be able to do that, right? Okay, last observational imprint of the cosmic web distribution. This is a very recent result, where people not looked at the mass distribution, but looked at what the mass distribution is basically implying with respect to the flows that are induced by the buildup of structure in the universe. That's a very hard, challenging, meticulous job, because you basically have to infer of the galaxies that you observe their velocity with respect to the expanding universe. The peculiar velocity. That's extremely hard. But by now, there is a compelling set of sample of galaxy peculiar velocities called Cosmic Flows 2, and now it's extension by Cosmic Flows 3, which was basically assembled by Brent Tully and his collaborators. And from that, they have basically made maps of the flows in the local universe. Now, what you see here is an image of the density distribution. That's basically the density contours. So you see clumps in the local universe. Each of the names is a real cluster. And you see the arrows is the velocities that have now been found, detected in these flow fields. And you see beautifully how these things are basically attracting the flow, basically causing the flow towards these high-density regions. But most interestingly, you see the shear flows in the filaments. You see that it's not, you know, only moving towards two, but because these filaments are hanging in between two clumps, the flows is out of the voids and then splits almost in a stream going towards one clump and the other clump, which is really shear flow in the local universe. And you clearly see it. In between clumps, you see these shearing motions now in the cosmic flows meeting. That's exactly what you see in simulations too. All this was real data.
And so, typical velocities?
A few hundreds of kilometers per second. For example, we ourselves are moving with 627 kilometers per second with respect to the universe. Most of it is due to these two guys, Shepley, and what we, this one, and let me see, it's not in this slice. We are moving basically in this direction, but there is another concentration in between, which is called the Great Attractor or Norma Cluster, and that those things make us move with this velocity, six, which is quite something, right? If you get stopped for going too hard, you can say to the police officer, you yourself, take yourself. I mean, so we know these velocities. It's around this order. So, coming back to the earlier question, now we have settled the question of what the cosmic web is and how this is formed. Where is it coming from? All of it actually emanates simply from the fact that in the early universe, there's small inhomogeneities in the mass distribution, extremely small, 10 to the minus 5, 13.8 billion years ago. And those things are, of course, observed in the microwave background. We see, for example, here a map turned inside out of WMAP, And it turns out that this defines beautifully a Gaussian random field of which the spectrum is very close to what is the standard model of structure formation, the Lambda CDM spectrum describing these fluctuations. These fluctuations, of course, result in overdensities, in valleys, and etc. So what do you get? Gravity basically says, okay, these points attract slightly harder than the average universe, these points slightly less. So what you get is that mass starts to move towards the higher density regions and out of the lower density regions. And this is going to be a runaway effect because the higher density regions assemble more mass. So the gravity perturbations start to become more and more prominent. So more and more mass is moving towards the high density regions and less towards the low density regions. The low density regions stream empty because most of them are transported to the high density regions. And in the end, 13.8 billion years ago, you end up from a structure that is almost like this with hardly any features recognizable, although you see some of the peaks, the mountain peaks in the valley, you end up with a structure that looks like this, pure because of gravity. Right? Most of the mass here in these lower density regions start to move up here, move up there, move over there, so you expect a huge void over there. That's exactly what you see here. In the void, depending on the resolutions, you still see some smaller structure, etc. You see this clump really recognizable over here. That's going to be the mountain peak in the early conditions that finally gave up over there. Later on, we will see that gravitational instability is explaining this part, right? Everything moves to higher density regions, etc., moves out of lower density regions. But there's going to be a second instability. The second instability will be crucial for the cosmic web understanding. That's the fact that gravitational instability never is isotropic, it's never spherical. Gravitational will always try to make things collapse in an anisotropic fashion. We will come back to that later on. But that's the second instability. That is very marked gravitational instability. So in terms of the cosmic web, when we look at that, oh, let me see. Okay, here you see an image. What happens? So this is the dark matter distribution. These are the filaments, and these are the walls in the same region. As time proceeds, so this is the redshift, and you see it counting down. Here's the number of years, and you see this would be 12 years, 13 years, and now we are where we are nowadays. This is the filaments, and you see there is not a lot in the low-density regions. And you see that the filaments, here you still see some remnants in blue, that's because they form the boundaries of what here in orange are the membranes, the sheets. So in terms of mass, you can have a look again. So you see it becomes more and more prominent web-like, and you see how the filaments are basically evolving, emptying. You also see that more and more of the small filaments are disappearing. They're disappearing in the high-density filaments, and you see how the same thing happens with the sheets, but then they are surrounded by heavier and heavier filaments. This is gravitational instabilities working. So we've seen those things. So one aspect that I wanted to treat is how these things hang together. What now we have recognized that there are filaments and walls. What is their story in terms of characteristics? I can say, I see filaments. But that's not very satisfactory. It doesn't give you much information. Certainly, you will not be able to identify what the underlying cosmology would be, etc. So you need to delve somewhat further into understanding some of the specific topics. In terms of evolution, what we will see is a connection between the filaments and the walls and the filaments and the clusters. Here I have two images, two diagrams, here a row of four and here a row of four. Both of them are the mass distribution seen from a halo in a simulation, in this CosmoGrid simulation, looking outside and following the mass distribution in time. So here you see it at the redshift of 3.7. Here you see it nowadays. And you see already what's going on. This is a sky distribution. So imagine you are looking out on the sky and you're mapping the mass distribution and you would be living in a wall. What would you see? You would see a circle on the sky, right? If you would look only on the projected distribution. If you would be living in a filament, you would be seeing two spots, right? Because only in that direction and in that direction you have mass. So take this into account and follow this and this. Here you see at the redshift of 3.7, you clearly see something here, a plane, a dominant plane, but around the dominant plane, there are lots of arteries. They're all different walls. As time proceeds, you see that these small arteries are merging into something that is more prominent. Still two over here and one over here. It's as if you see two walls very close together on the sky. You also recognize that in there, there are two hotspots forming. They are a filament in these walls. So apparently, in these walls, mass is contracting towards these higher density regions. And in the end, what you get is a faint remnant of a wall-like distribution with two hotspots over here. So what happened is that a distribution of some smaller walls apparently was contracting more and more towards a wall. And as that was happening, inside the wall, the mass is moving towards filaments. And in the end, you end up with a prominent filament. It's from the perspective of another halo, it's even more prominent if you see it here. Here, you clearly see a wall. And as time proceeds, you see in the end, clearly, only two hotspots lead. So this is a wall in which you basically see all the stuff contracting towards a filament. So there's clearly a connection between those guys. Okay? In terms of time, you see here the total length of filaments. And yeah?
Are these Newtonian simulations? Or
yeah. GM? This is all pure. So this is assuming standard cosmology. And the simulations are, you know, up to 100 megaparsecs. So everything is approximated by Newtonian gravity. Okay. So what you see here is exactly what you saw in that movie. The filaments in time, here's a redshift of 2, here's a redshift of 0. So you see that the length of the filamentary network is decreasing in time. That's because the filaments start to merge into larger and larger filaments, and the small ones are gradually disappearing. That's the same thing for the walls. This is the surface area of the walls. And clearly, at larger redshifts, you have larger surface areas than at the smaller than at what is left at the later time. So you clearly see a decrease. Now, in terms of internal structure, you see, for example, here the linear density along a filament, and you see they are not homogeneous structures. They are very inhomogeneous. If you look at the diameter, you see variations in diameters. But for example, you could also take the profiles of these filaments, and you see here the radial profiles along the perpendicular direction. And you see that, for example, here is heavy filaments that have a radius of more than 10 megaparsecs. Most of them are around 5, and some of the more tenuous ones are less than half a megaparsecs. So there's a huge variation. But you see they are pretty much well-defined in terms of their density structure. So you can go on and on and on in terms of the characteristics. Let me skip this one. And proceed to, for astronomers, very interesting observation, that is the kind of galaxies that live in these various objects. And here you see the mass spectra of the galaxies and of the halos of the galaxies in the various components. And you see that, for example, this is the mass spectrum of galaxies in filaments. This is the mass spectrum in clusters. And that's really in accordance with what we see. The heaviest galaxies are living in cluster halos. But most of the galaxies seem to be well-behaved with a divergence towards smaller galaxies. Most of the galaxies are small dwarf-like in filaments. But what you really also see that in voids there are also galaxies, but they have a far lower mass and in far lesser abundance than the ones in the filaments. So you do see some galaxies in voids, but they are small little blobs. In the walls, you also see that they are more prominent than the ones in the voids, but they're tenuous. Now, the problem for the walls, and here you see a wall, with a wall, if you look in the observations, they are basically marked by minor galaxies, 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 solar masses, nothing in comparison to galaxies like our own. So if you look at such a thing, and you have a survey of galaxies that is only going to a certain brightness, you will miss these guys. You can't see them. On top of that, their surface density is really low. So when you look at real galaxy surveys, overall, the walls are not part of the picture because you can't see them. That explains why. But the filaments are all the way there. And they are basically what most of the galaxies are about. So, let me get to the dynamics. The anisotropic collapse that I explained to you is, you see over here, why do we have filaments or walls? Well, imagine that you have a blob that is almost spherical and that starts to collapse, but it's not totally spherical because such a thing doesn't exist in nature nor in Gaussian random fields. The tiniest deviation from sphericity means that the peculiar gravitational acceleration along the minor axis is larger than the ones along the higher axis. That means it starts to fall faster along the minor axis. And you already can imagine that this is a runaway effect, right? This becomes more and more prominent as time proceeds. So everything goes first along the minor axis, then a second axis. And if you're lucky, that is, if it's really overdense and bound, you might do it along the longest axis, but that's not even necessary. So you either left over with walls, or if it goes along two directions, with filaments. That's basically all of the underlying physics of the formation of anisotropic structures. Of course, we do see a coherence, and you may wonder why are these things actually collapsing faster along one direction than the other one. It's not only their internal structure, it's also the gravitational field of the structures around them, which are actually causing a differential gravity that is tidal fields. And it's these tidal fields, yeah?
How much damping do you need to accomplish the formation of walls from things which are...
How much?
Because you have these two walls which are falling towards each other, and without dissipation, they just go through and come back up here.
Can I come back to that in a minute?
Sure.
Because it's an effect that I'm going to discuss in terms of Seldovich.
Sure.
Okay? Because it's one of the points that's come in. So here you have basically clusters, and in between, you see with green bars the gravitational deformation field that is causing the anisotropic collapse. And you see that indeed you get a filament over here because everything along the filament is making it collapse faster along this minor axis. This already indicates the fact that apparently for the anisotropic collapse, these clumps, these clusters, are extremely important in determining the final layout of the cosmic mass distribution in terms of the clusters being the dominant source of gravitational instability and gravitational anisotropic forces. As was pointed out in 1996 by Dick Bond, Dmitry Pikosyan, and Lev Kofman, in a paper that basically coined the word, the cosmic web. This is called the cosmic web theory. So that's where it's basically coming from. So how is this going in a real, under real circumstances? And that's coming back to a point that was made slightly earlier. If we take the real mass distribution, we might actually look at the description of how the mass is moving. Mass is moving from its initial position to its final position. And as was shown by Zeldovich in 1970, the first stage, the linear stage, you can extremely well approximate by a linear displacement that is relating the linear displacement factor to the velocity potential and that to the gravitational potential of the initial perturbation. Now, what you get is a structure that is astonishingly good, well reproducing what you see in simulations, by a very simple theory. This is the Zeldovich theory. And you see that everything builds up this cosmic web structure. This looks very much like the cosmic web, but this doesn't. At some point, you start to make a mistake. The mistake is that at the moment, stuff is going through basically singularities, and you basically get multi-stream regions. Zeldovich cannot work anymore because it's assuming basically one stream motion. It doesn't damp the motion. So gravity is not damped due to the self-gravity of these structures. That's where Zeldovich has a problem and why something more sophisticated has to come up. Everything in terms of Zeldovich comes basically back to the deformation tensor. And that deformation tensor is what we will be looking at in much more detail. That determines the structure. And finally, you get the density, and you see that the density is determined by the eigenvalues of this deformation tensor, that is, the gradient of the velocity with respect to the position in the initial positions. These three parameters are, in the end, determining all the morphology that we see around us. But not completely. Let me, if you have the time, proceed with this a little bit further, because here is basically the addition to the distribution evolving by Zeldovich, but with a formalism that came up around 1989 for the first time. An addition to the Zeldovich approximation that augmented its dynamics, that involves the hierarchical distribution of all these filaments and all these voids and etc. by looking at the equation of motion of the Zeldovich equation. It turns out that if you write down the Zeldovich equation, in the end, it is nothing else than a sourceless force equation, Euler equation, like you see over here. This is the Euler equation, and the Zeldovich approximation only assumes that there is no source term, there is no gravity. It doesn't take into account its self-gravity. That's why you see these orbits rushing through each other and why things go slightly wrong. That brings us to a new solution. This was done in 1989. They basically put in a hypothetical term, and the hypothetical term was an adhesion term, a viscosity term, with a second-order gradient of the velocity field. And if you look well, you see that this is Berger's equation. And Berger's equation, in this sense, is almost like a hypothetical model for what happens to the self-gravity of these structures. So what's the advantage? The advantage of this is that you can solve this mathematically, directly, analytically, by basically a mapping between the final position of a mass element and its original mass element, all predicated on the initial gravitational field potential. Now, this is a complex structure, a complex equation, but if you look well, what basically happens is that you have the initial potential field lifted up by a parabolic quadratic equation. And what you have to do here is basically identify the structures that are caught in the valleys and identify them with the peaks around them. That actually leads to, finally, a distribution where you stick, and here you see basically what's happening. At one point, you see that all the mass in between valleys is stuck in one singularity, which can be a filament, or a cluster, or a wall. And when you take this into account and take the evolution of this potential, you see that as time proceeds, things start to move towards each other and finally merge into dominant structures like this. Now, one-dimensional, you can solve this quite easily. But multidimensional, three dimensions, is extremely hard. You need geometry to do that. Finally, what you see is that you have to take into account that mass is moving towards walls and along two directions, along three directions towards filaments, and two nodes along four directions, all in this initial potential field. And Johan Hidding, who was a graduate student of mine, solved this purely geometrically on the basis of using Voronoi and Delaunay tessellations, basically obtained from the initial potential field and its structure. And by using this, he was able to follow the evolution of the cosmic web, basically getting rid of the damping and looking at what happens to these structures. So he's basically taking a Lagrangian, the distribution of Lagrangian structure, maps them towards the final Eulerian structure, and you see what's happening in time. You see basically in blue the filaments, in red the clumps, and you see how things evolve in time. You get larger and larger voids, you get larger and larger filaments, and you see basically the evolution of the cosmic web. So that's what I would like to come at a halt. Here you see the same thing as what you saw in the Seldovich simulation, but here now you see as it is evolved, taking into account self-gravity on the basis of the Hedesian model, and you see that you very nicely can model the hierarchical distribution of all these filamentary and wall-like patterns and of the voids. Things very nicely stick into the regions in between them, and you see the buildup, the hierarchical buildup of the cosmic web. So now we have a means to, for example, study the sensitivity of the cosmic web to different cosmologies. Here is the cosmic web, very easily calculated in this Hedesian model. Doesn't take a lot of time. It's not a supercomputer calculation. You can almost do it on your laptop. Here in a cosmological model with a lot of small-scale structure in its initial power spectrum, and here one with much more large-scale structure. You see that the cosmic web is clearly different in these structures. You see that the filaments are different. You see that the clumps are different. So there's a huge potential of basically using the filaments and sort of exploring their different properties and getting towards a better understanding of the cosmic web and its connection to the cosmological parameters. So I would like to leave it over here. Thank you very much.
We start with questions from students. Any questions from the students?
So in the Seldovich
formulas, and you mentioned the displacement is some d times gradient phi. So what is that? Is it some effective?
Okay. Let me see. What it is the dt is basically a usual a global. It's a global time parameter, which basically specifies the growth of structure, and you can use it as a time parameter. Yeah, here it is. You mean this term? This term is what's called the density growth factor. It basically specifies how fast in time structure is growing in the universe if you assume linear instability theory. So it's a simple linear term. For example, if you would be living in an Einstein de Sitter universe, it would be going like t to the 2/3. If you would be living in an empty universe, that is a universe that would be, you know, very underdense, not the cosmological parameter, it would basically become constant, and you see that structure growth comes to a halt. It's a universal factor, and that's very important because it means that you basically can take it as the time, right? It's a one-on-one mapping between real time and that growth factor, right? So read it almost as time. And then you get this vector quantity, which is basically the gradient of a velocity potential. And that velocity potential is one-on-one with the gravitational potential. This thing you always get in when you look in fluid dynamics and do linear Lagrangian instability theory, this is the first term that you get. Now, then you have to basically fill in what the dynamics, underlying dynamics is. Here it's gravitational instability in a cosmology, and that's why you get that term.
So I guess I wanted to return to Nyash's question. It does seem like the process of, let's say, defining filaments should be a scale-dependent thing, that I could decide, I could smooth on different scales, and depending on what scale I smoothed on, I mean, basically, I could make some isodensity contour, and then I could measure the shape of that contour and say I'm in a filament because it's long. But then if I picked a different density contour, I would or wouldn't. So could you just explain a bit more, how does the multi-scale?
Okay.
I mean, it seems like there should be a free parameter or something in the multi-scale.
No, there is no free parameter. It's exactly what you explained. What we basically do is we take a three-dimensional distribution and we smooth the three-dimensional distribution on every scale. So you basically get a four-dimensional, what's called scale space. So you basically get a distribution on any scale, and that's almost like a continuous four axis, right? Subsequently, you're doing exactly what you say. Each of these scales, you're going to determine locally the shape at every position. So for example, when it's elongated like this on one scale, you say, well, on that scale, it looks like a filament. Now, a scale higher up in the hierarchy would say, well, yes, but this is also a filament, and this is even larger, is also a filament. So now you have to connect them. Now, for that, and there we borrowed from medical research, we use what's called a filter bank. So we compare the strength of the filamentary signal on the different scales, and we pick out the most prominent scale. How does this work? For example, you're living in a very fat filament, like here. Now, of course, if you would go on the smaller scale, it still would look like a filament, right? But it's because it's part of this larger one. Then you go to an even larger scale than the real scale of this thick one. Then, of course, the signal starts to become less and less strong. The shape, the elongation, starts to become less and less strong. Now, this filter bank is actually organized such that it picks out the scale where this filamentary signal is strongest. Then, on top of that, you also have to take into account, in the case of the filaments, we also take the so-called percolation properties into account. Now, we take into account how they connect to each other, and we look for the filaments that cause, you know, that take into account that everything is nicely connected with each other. I mean, it would not be like little thing here and then a gap and a little thing here. And no, you're looking for the ones that are coherent because they are the filaments. And that's basically, admittedly, a little bit of cookery because you have to put in some of your previous knowledge about this. But this is basically what's done. Now, the form of all these filter banks we borrowed from medical research because, you know, they had defined this already, you know, what are arteries in your body? And they used this apparently demonstrably successfully. I mean, they use it in hospitals. So we assume they're doing a good job and they work for us.
I mean, I guess a related question is, you could also think of this in terms of the dynamics, right? The halos are collapsing.
Oh, for the halos, we do exactly that. Yeah. So for the halos, we look for so the halos are on different scales, and then we look actually for the largest scale that has fully collapsed and virilized.
Okay.
So we have several criteria for the physics of this.
But for the filaments, they don't have to be collapsing on two axes or anything.
No. We could potentially, when we get a better understanding for the dynamics of the filaments, and that's another aspect that we're looking into now, phase-based dynamics and multi, you know, when things become multi-stream, potentially you could build that in too and sharpen the whole thing. But in the disguise that I showed you, we haven't done that.
I'm wondering, does dark matter play any role in the model that you described?
Dark matter is what basically determines everything, because the dark matter is, first of all, the dominant species of mass, and therefore dominates in the gravitational field. Not only that, up till the recombination epoch, so it's 380,000 years after the Big Bang, dark matter can grow in its perturbations, while baryons cannot, right? They basically pressure dominate it, so they cause, on these superhorizon scales, they cause these acoustic waves, so they don't grow, really. But underneath them, the dark matter is basically digging the potential wells deeper and deeper. And so the dark matter is basically laying out the complete structure of the large-scale universe way before the baryons can start falling in. So they are the dominant species of mass and therefore the dominant species of gravity, and they already did a lot of work in structure formation before recombination. So most of it is the story of dark matter.
Yeah, what confused me about the reason I'm asking the question is that when you were describing, for example, you know, some shape, and then two filaments that are closer to one another are attracting each other, it seemed as if it was based on just visible matter attracting each other.
No, in the observational part, it was visible stuff, except the lensing part. All the other ones was mostly, when I showed simulations, I only showed, in this case, the dark matter simulations. We also have, you know, ones with gas and stuff like that.
So dark matter made visible by simulation.
Yeah. Yeah. In the simulations, it doesn't look dark.
remember correctly, Zelda, which also studied theory of flames, where you have filaments and sheets. And, so I wonder if there's a deep mathematical connection.
Thank you. What you're alluding to is exactly the reason I'm here. This is what This is the three-dimensional extension of what Seldovich did. What you're alluding to is the singularities that are forming in the distribution of mass. When you look in phase space, so not only three-dimensional space, but six-dimensional space, the mass distribution is basically a three-dimensional sheet in six-dimensional space. And it folds under the force of gravity. That's basically what the process is. Now, in this folding process, you can recognize what kind of singularities are forming. It's the story of the folds, the butterflies, and all these kind of things, what Arnold did, singularity theory. That's exactly the reason I'm here, working with Job, because Job basically solved the whole issue for any dimension. And here you see what you get in that case for the filaments. So basically, you can take the Seldovich prescription and already identify where the filament should be. So we're not bothered by the crossing. It's just taking into account you can already use these singularities. It's a very, very interesting field. It's only now surfacing again. Since the last few years, several groups have started to recognize that actually to understand the whole process, look at phase space and look at the multi-streaming character of all what's going on. And then you get this rich pattern that you see. So thank you for asking.
So how does dark energy play into the growth of these voids and filament length changes?
So the idea, well, you know, dark energy represents a expulsive force, but it's not very prominent on a galaxy scale. We don't recognize it in our galaxy. And one of the reasons is because it's so extremely weak. So you would like to look in places where the density is actually very low, so the attractive force of gravity, mostly dark matter, is very, very low. So where are these regions, you know, where you basically take the full gravitational force, where you have the attractive force, dark matter and baryons, and at the same time the repulsive force, and the repulsive force being at least a fair fraction of the attraction. Well, the place to look then is in the lowest density regions, and they are the voids. And so that's one reason why voids would be very attractive to look at them. And the other reason is that voids are quite unique in this story. While the overdensities can grow almost limitless, they can collapse up till an overdensity of infinity, right? So they can have a density excess of almost infinity. In reality, it's around the most prominent one is 1,000 for clusters of galaxies. Voids never get emptier than density deficit is -1. You cannot get emptier than empty. That means that voids are extremely sensitive to the environment. Their self-gravity is relatively low with respect to the environment. So the environment is having a huge impact on the evolution of the voids and keeps on having that up till today. The environment, what is the environment kicking in? That is basically the development of the structure on an overall scale. That's this density growth factor. Now, the growth of structure on the overall scale is very sensitive to the dark energy, right? That's kicking in with the dark energy. So that also the external influence on the voids is also dominated by the dark energy over there. And that's why people recognize that voids might be interesting regions. And actually, there's a range of groups now trying to get sort of hold of voids as probes of dark energy in, for example, Euclid and all these large surveys that are coming up in the coming years. Does that answer your question a bit?
Two more questions? Just two questions or no? Okay, last question here.
So if I understand correctly, you can only observe these things, this web in visible gas and lenses. So the question is dark matter really necessary for these webs to exist? Do you consider this as evidence for dark matter, or can it be compatible with some kind of alternative modified gravity theory?
In the standard cosmological model, you couldn't do without dark matter because you simply would not have the structure around, there would not have been enough gravity to form the structure that we see nowadays. You would not have been able to form our galaxy even, right? Because there simply would not have been enough gravity to assemble matter and establish, you know, prominent clumps. Like
people have alternative theories.
Yes. So what's happening if you take a modified gravity? I know that some of the models that were simulated by, for example, Bajoli in Durham, do produce these structures and have some of the characteristics. So potentially that seems to be possible. But, you know, it's only a few groups who have been able to do something like that. So it's not that you can base yourself on an extensive amount of study.
Okay, so if anybody has more questions for him, he's here until next Tuesday. And we also have snacks downstairs in the cloakroom starting now. So thanks for reading again.